So here we are, and the system is broke. American dream has gone up in smoke. So stop sitting there all brokenhearted. Let's get this motherfucking party started. Lady Liberty is ringing a bell, and we're driving us straight into hell. But don't worry, we got what you need. Crank up the volume till your eardrums bleed. Go and make America, America again.
Welcome everyone to the A Better Way to a Podcast. We are your hosts, Andrew and Jordan. I am Jordan, he is Andrew, and today we are here with Thomas Gibbons Neff, a New York Times reporter, a former Marine, a war correspondent, super cool dude, and a guy who likes to play Red Dead Redemption in his free time. So thanks for coming on the show, man.
Really defining qualities.
Yeah, super defining qualities. Just got to humanize the guy a little bit. You know, everyone thinks that that reporters are, you know, soulless.
Everybody thinks that?
Husks of, not us. Not us, because we like him. But
would you say he's a credit to his kind?
I mean, that's headstone material. Super cool dude who plays Red Dead Redemption in his spare time.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
Man, I can't believe I'm gonna have to redo that one because I called you a former Marine, and I can't believe I fucking
No. You can. This is listen.
Yeah. You could say former, not ex.
I mean, you could say. I mean, like,
I know it's goofy. Like,
it's really just who draws out the people on the internet. It's like former Marine. Like, it's like you're not currently like this is just factual information. But
yeah.
And then people are like, well, yeah, people don't like to be called former. Like, the people who don't like to be called former Marines, I think like 1988 and prior, and that cuts off in like 1975.
Can I also say that as a non-Marine, I also don't give a shit.
Well, it's good. That, yeah. All right, 3 out of 3, then we're good. We don't need to fix anything. Yeah, so I met you when you came out to my house and hung out in my basement and asked me a bunch of questions about A Better Way to A. I was like, I remember being relatively nervous because I had never had a reporter in my house before, but you're a normal dude, and I think we're about the same age. My wife was texting me the whole time. She's like, how's it going? And I was like, he's not weird. He's not weird at all, I promise. Like...
I've never met like a weird reporter. Every time I've ever interacted with like a journalist or a reporter, it's just like, I don't know, just like normal.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm weird. I think most of my reporter friends are, you know, on the weird side of things. But yeah, I mean,
maybe I'm fucking weird. So
if I code switch to normal enough, then like I'm good.
You're masking well.
That's exactly. I'm like, you know, I'm like gritting my teeth here, like I'm on a podcast. Like,
yeah, that's, be cool. Be normal. Be normal. Be normal.
Do you see my camo pocket?
Yeah. Do you see his camo pocket? Means I'm here. I'm showing up for the community, the gun culture.
Oh yeah,
that's all you need, dude.
Yeah, need to like scratch behind my head more. Like I've got tattoos too. I don't know what that tells you, but they're there. They're edgy.
It means something.
I'm a normal guy. Hello, fellow normal people.
Yeah, yeah. Hello, fellow kids.
Oh man. Well, is there? I mean, I know there's a whole lot I missed, but you want to say a couple things about yourself and how you got into where you are now and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, for sure. My name is Thomas Gibbons Neff. I'm currently covering gun culture and policy for the New York Times. And prior to that, I covered the war in Ukraine for 2 years in and out, like on and off. And then before that, I was covering the war in Afghanistan and the fall of the country back to the Taliban. And then before that, I was covering the U.S. military in the Pentagon from DC. And then, I was in the Marine Corps from 2007 to 11. I was enlisted. I was in the infantry, did 2 deployments to Afghanistan. And then after that, went to school. And that's kind of how I got into journalism. Started writing, I guess they were like veteran oriented not think pieces, just like essays about, I guess, being a veteran. And that they got published in like the At War blog for the Times. That was like my first time I was ever published. And then applied for internships and I got picked up at the Washington Post my junior summer. Wait, no, Yeah, junior summer, because Bezos had just bought the Post and they were kind of expanding military coverage and they were like a military blog or vertical. So I was an intern for that. And then, the Washington Post hired me the next summer. And then I was at the Post from 15 to 17. And then I joined the New York Times.
So just lighthearted stuff, just fun, just chill stuff the whole time.
I mean, definitely wasn't repeatedly traumatizing myself through my various life decisions.
So we went from like active duty, like combat theater deployments to nonstop rehashing and reliving possibly like the most traumatic events of your life. And then now you're here.
Yeah, definitely. That's definitely like one therapy session. Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Well, it's been a lot, but it's been about kind of like,
Promise you, if we don't end up in civil war, then I promise you that covering gun culture is going to be a lot more fun than the war in Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been less stressful as far as, I mean, it's stressful in a lot of different ways, but it's as, imminent life and limb.
Yeah.
It's been tough. I mean, it's the last few weeks has been tough kind of watching it from afar.
Yeah. We can talk about that if you want.
Yeah, I mean it's a spicy topic, but yeah, we can talk about whatever.
I do want to know like how you got picked for covering gun culture. Like, first of all, it surprises me that the New York Times is even specifically interested in gun culture. But I also kind of want to know like how you ended up with that job specifically.
Yeah, sure. So I mean, covering Ukraine and Afghanistan, I hit a wall and wanted to stop doing that just because I think it was unsustainable in a lot of ways, just mentally. There's a lot of fulfillment to it, obviously, but I think it was like metal on metal at that point. Anyway, I just pitched the gun culture beat because I thought, I was covering conflict because of my background, and that's what I felt that I kind of brought to the paper in that way. And I thought, well, what else can like my prior experiences help like inform our coverage? So was why I pitched gun culture.
Do you foresee a lot of like conflict in gun culture, or do you just mean that, just given the background of guns as a bulwark against violence?
No, not so much like, oh, I covered conflict, therefore like that kind of translates over to gun culture. More just like my background, right? Like having been around firearms in the Marines and growing up.
That makes sense. And you're a gun owner too. I mean, we were talking about, I think one of the times you called me, you were talking about how you just bought an optic for your Glock. And I remember telling, I forget who I was talking to, but I was like, no, he's not just like a cyborg from the times. Like he has a gun. He has at least one gun.
Hey, cyborgs have guns too, dude.
And they're like self-mounted. They're like in their eye.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I would love to talk to you about that, man. Cause I've had a very good, you've made a great impression on me. I've had a great experience with you. I love the story that I've seen some of your other stories too. You've got like I told you earlier today, the story that you just put out about the New American Gun Store, it felt like I was watching a movie that I'd seen before, but through the perspective of a different character, in the sense that, I think the majority of your readers are not gun owners, or at least not like us, sitting in a basement with a beanie and Alpenfly shirt on, looking like I'm recording an ISIS video. But and it was very, we're always saying that we want to make gun culture more mainstream, because end result, best case scenario, gun culture is normalized to the point where the majority of people own guns, more so than now, and gun control is no longer on the table as a political plan for politicians. It's a career killer. Also ends up being so that we have to focus on actual solutions instead of just band-aids. But I see stories like yours as a huge step forward, because I think typically our interactions with the media have been limited to, after school shootings or after AR-15 bans or during bans, very, very like high conflict, high emotion times. And you just writing a story about the New American Gun Store and some of the culture behind that, I think, is lends an insight into an area that the general public who is not involved with this doesn't usually get to see. And I know I'm very appreciative of that. I've gotten a bunch of really positive feedback from the people I've shared that article with. Do you see this as a, is there momentum in this direction? Because I also noticed the Times put out that video about unlikely gun owners. And there was just an article about trans gun owners. This is not something that I would have called like 5 years ago. Do you see these kind of stories now as some kind of like paradigm shift in gun culture and in mainstream media? Or is this just like a phase that's coming and going?
I don't know. I mean, the way I see, like, you know, the story that published today, right? Like, you can hold like both things in your hands, like that, you know, talking about bans, school shootings, you know, when rifles or firearms become weapons, right? And not just like the, you know, for a hobbyist. Like, you can do both. I just think that over the last two decades, that just hasn't really been a priority for a lot of outlets, or, you know, they didn't know how to do, you know, walk and chew gum at the same time. And I think, yeah, I think there's always room to like tell different stories, I think. And I, you know, it's been great that the Times has kind of had my back on doing this line of coverage. But again, it's just, I think it just comes down to like, you know, what papers want to do and the stories that they want to tell. Yeah. I mean, it's an important line. I mean, there's just so many layers of, you know, any, you know, subculture in the United States, and there's no reason not to like, you know, spend time with them without vilifying or othering. And I think that's the overall goal, right? Like, I kind of wrote an essay about it. Yeah, you know, maybe a lot of the New York Times subscribers are not gun owners or didn't grow up around guns, and maybe some did. And, you know, that people who own guns and, you know, have experienced, you know, the hobby, the subculture, can read the article and take something away from it. And people who have no idea what this is all about can learn from it. And I think that's like, that's my objective. Yeah, I think it's going to be hard, and it is hard, and to a certain extent, because like you said, like, it's like we were talking earlier, it's like what lens you pick for your camera and how you write the story without getting like too in the weeds or too, you know, othery.
Yeah.
Making it seem like these people are aliens. Yeah.
This isn't so much a question, but I just want to point out something I noticed about this article, specifically the one that just came out, the New American Gun Shop, was that, you know, a lot of times I read coverage of, you know, things happening in gun culture, even when it's not in the context of like some horrible thing happened with a gun, there's this element of like hand-wringing and this like exasperated quality when a journalist will describe something that I find particularly normal just because it's something that I'm, you know, exposed to all the time, like 3D printing guns, or, you know, a gun shop that sells like, you know, different color, like AR-15 accessories, you know,
or suppressors. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, it's like somebody will describe something that is just like every day for me in a way that like they just found out about it and it's scary. And I find that really off-putting. And I noticed that was like absent in this article, that, you know, the article you wrote has like a very like kind of normal, like unbothered tone to it that I found very unusual in coverage of stuff like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I mean, that's also a choice, right? Like if I write AR-15, do I need to write every time that it's appeared in a mass shooting? I think like and that's kind of like how you account for your audience and, you know, assume that they're intelligent, that they have, you know, are reading the New York Times, they live in the United States, they're well aware of, you know, A, what these things are, B, what they do and how they've been used, right? They've been used in school shootings. They're also used by hobbyists and, you know, people who are a part of a culture that maybe they're not totally familiar with, but they know that it exists. And that's tough because I think there's a time and a place for where you need to remind the reader of like what these things are and what they're capable of, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's always like, you know, owning an AR-15 and like, you know, I like going to the range, I like shooting. It's a hobby for me, like rock climbing or going for a run. It's like where I can kind of just like focus on this thing that I'm doing in front of me and enjoy it. But also like, you know, this is the same type of rifle that I carried in Afghanistan that I you know, used in harm's way to defend my life and my friends. You know, it's like kind of always holding those two. And it's like, when do you, as a journalist, like, when do you like bring them together? And like, yeah, when do you keep them apart? Mm-hmm. And I think that's like always the struggle. And I don't think there is a right answer to that. And I'm sure, you know, I might in the future, or might have in the past, like kind of missed the right timing for that kind of exposition. But yeah, it's an ongoing process.
I think you did it, whether it was your intention or not. I think you did a good job of humanizing gun culture in a new way, or in a way that I'm just not used to seeing with a publication that isn't either sponsored or done for a firearms publication, like a gun magazine or something, like a blog on firearm specific topics. Yeah, no, it's, I don't know, it was refreshing to read, to be honest. And it's just, it's, you know, I don't want to say like a warm and fuzzy feeling, but like, it's refreshing to see stories that you would not normally see reported on. Like, you know, for us, it's normal to say that trans people are buying guns at higher rates than ever before, because it's what we surround ourselves with. And it's one of the primary reasons that we're here. But to see that reported on by the Times, or, you know, the Washington Post, or, you know, in giving the, I think we spoke the other day on that Instagram video where the Times posted about the new reluctant gun owner. I forget what the name of the article was, but the comments were just of people that could not believe that it was not sponsored by the NRA, or that it was not, you know, some kind of like bought and paid for type shill story, because they are emotionally involved in it. And, you know, like anybody who's ever emotionally involved in anything, obviously bias exists in all of us. But I think seeing those things and seeing those articles come up more and more frequently just does a very good job of humanizing something that we've been trying to humanize for decades. So yeah, that's there's no real question there. It's just you know, I appreciate seeing that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Have you been surprised by the reception to your work so far in that on that beat?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of like chipping away at, I think there's just a general aversion for, I guess, those in gun, like the gun community surrounded by gun culture, to talk to a New York Times reporter, just because we kind of have whatever reputation we carry into that space,
yeah,
like on our backs. And so, you know, my goal is to kind of, again, it's not like I'm deciding to write certain stories in a certain way to kind of gain access, but just kind of demonstrating that, like, you know, kind of what Jordan, you were just saying, that there is like a way to cover this in a fashion that hasn't been done before, that shows that like we can walk and chew gum at the same time, and that, yeah, we want to, and we are behind those stories, right? It's not like I pitched this story and there was like opposition, or like I showed how I wrote it and they were like, no, we need to
punch it up a little bit.
Yeah, punch it up for a little, you know, make it, you know, demonize the AR-15.
Yeah, this isn't scary.
Yeah, make it scary. There was, you know, there was none of that, right? And yeah, I think there's just this idea that like the New York Times, or, you know, and mainstream media is like this monolith that like does thing in a certain way because it hates X or hates Y, when it's just a human endeavor, just like anything else.
I think it's very easy for people to assume that there is like, you know, like a conspiracy against them, rather than that there's just a variety of people whose experiences don't line up with them. And that, you know, like a lot of people that end up writing for the New York Times are probably just people that don't have a lot of experience and do find some of this stuff a little bit scary.
Yeah. I mean, I think that really comes down to it. I mean, it's just really like, how much is everyone exposed to certain things that they're covering? And, you know, a lot of the time it's not a lot. I mean, it's just the nature of the thing.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, no, it's like Steve Gutowski being an advisor to CNN on the topic of firearms,
yeah,
news. It's something that we should welcome whenever we get the opportunity to have somebody who's knowledgeable on firearms to report on firearms.
Knowledgeable about firearms, but also fucking normal. You know, because because there's people that know a lot about guns that I don't want going near CNN.
Yeah, 100%. I don't want them anywhere near a camera. Never mind just CNN. Like, please, you know, and it's like whenever we get on Twitter or whenever we get on, I mean, social media in general, we're always confronted with these people who are perpetually online or these, you know, there are like, I'm sure you're familiar, there are gun tubers who I would not want to be the face of the gun community because I feel like they would do more harm than good. Just because they're knowledgeable doesn't mean that they're going to be a good ambassador for the gun community. And I really don't think that we need a mascot. I really don't think we need a face for the gun community. I just think we need honest reporting. And that's really it. It's so hard to find unbiased reporting when it comes to anything political, but guns specifically, because you know, any of the hot points in an election, guns, abortion, border security, anything like that, you're going to see something that's it's much harder to find an unbiased and unemotional story. But I'll say it one more time, and then I promise I'll stop stroking you here. But that's how I felt reading your stuff, is that it just felt like it was very matter of fact, and like this is the way it is. I think it was good. You asked me what I thought about it, and I had typed out, "It was good!" exclamation mark, and then nothing else for like a good 20 minutes because I was thinking about how to say it in like a way that was going to not. I couldn't just give you "it was good."
Yeah, if you just said that, I would have been like, "Oh my god,
my god, I fucked it up."
What did I do?
I'm fucking sucked.
I'm not coming on that podcast. I can't handle this.
So you've also spoken on things like 3D printed guns.
Yeah. Let's switch into that.
Yeah. This is a contentious topic because it's something that not many people other than the ones who are in the industry know about. And we hear 3D printed ghost guns all the time on the news, especially now with Luigi Mangione. There's this, albeit, you know, possibly appropriately depending on who you are, if your only experience with 3D printed guns is Luigi and
like when they show up in a murder, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. Then, you know, what else do you have to go for? You're not terminally online like the rest of us. But you mentioned how 3D printed firearms turn up at crime scenes. And I wonder if there's also some merit in talking about how they're being used in places like Myanmar.
Yeah. Using them in Myanmar against the fascist government there, that's a crime. They're showing up at crime scenes there, right? Like, I mean, it's just a different kind of crime in a different circumstance.
Yeah, I mean, well, 3D printed guns is kind of like, you know, if I were to like look at stories or storylines as like 100 level, 200 level, like PhD level, you know, I think 3D printed guns, its unique subculture, the people in it, and the relatively small community that kind of is pioneering it. Like that's, I think that's like a tough puzzle, and I probably don't know enough to speak authoritatively about like the many motives and reasons why, you know, people get into that field and create. You know, a lot of it is, I feel like there's like a certain pride of building these creations and or building these, you know, firearms better than the last iteration. And just that it kind of like is a, in my head, right, this is like my perspective as I learn about this topic, right? It's like restless rifle syndrome, right? Of a, like constantly tweaking, constantly upgrading. And then the next iteration of that, like learning these skills or like building an AR-15 versus like, I'm going to like, you know, push the envelope and build a 3D printed gun that can do X or do Y better than the last one. And I think there is like, there's like pride in that. And then there's also like the idea of like arming, you know, rebels in Myanmar, right? Of like this idea of exporting a tool that can be used for good,
right?
Or perceived good, you know, like in whatever side you're sitting on. And then like, again, it's always like, there's always the backside of it, right? Like it's always a double-edged sword
because
at the end of the day, a gun's a gun and it can be used for whatever you want it for, whoever gets their hands on it. Yeah. I mean, I think it, again, it's like it's a difficult puzzle and it's definitely something that I need to do more reporting on. But it is, you know, much like I kind of see, you know, FPVs in Ukraine as
the
future of, you know, modern war, just because of my own experiences, just kind of orbiting the 3D gun community, I think it's definitely the future of gun culture, or like what, you know, guns will be in the future.
There's a through line here, right? So like, you know, we're talking about, you know, arming like resistance movements. You know, there was like the Liberator airdropped into over Europe in World War II. And the first like 3D printed gun design was named after that, because that was, you know, what the creator had in mind when he made that. There's the FGC, the Fuck Gun Control, that was designed by Jay Stark, that's now being used in Myanmar, you know, because you can export these designs to places you can't export raw materials to, right? So, you know, you can't get guns there, you can't get the materials to make guns there, but if they have what they need already, you can show them how to make it. You're talking about Ukraine, you know, civilians needed weaponry in Ukraine. You know, luckily they were able to get like factory made firearms, but now we're talking about like drones and drone warfare. Well, Hoffman Tactical, who's you know, a well-known 3D printed gun guy on YouTube, is now playing with drones. He's playing with 3D printing bodies for drones, you know, ostensibly as like, you know, a form of armament, right? And he has to be very careful, because you can't, you know, you have to, there's like NFA requirements for playing with explosives.
You can drop baseballs from drones.
Sure, right, right.
I mean, whatever you really want, you know. There was a guy in Connecticut that attached a Glock to his.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple years ago.
guy in Connecticut, is that you?
Yes.
No, it was not me.
It was some other guy. But the concept is being proven that, you know, with like, with off-the-shelf electronics and 3D printing, you can make. He and, you know, like the rotors, he's 3D printing the rotor, like the blades for the rotors. So it's like with just minimal off the shelf parts and 3D printing, he can make an FPV drone, you know, that could be capable in that role, you know, after some iteration. Right. And so it's like, it's all kind of connected in my mind. You know, for me, when we talk about 3D printing, it's very difficult for me sometimes to bridge that gap in one conversation with someone who's like, you know, just found out that you can 3D print a gun that you can use in a murder, you know?
Yeah. It's a hard sell.
Yeah. And I've got like this whole fucking, like, you know, it's like Charlie Day with the pin board behind him trying to explain, and, you know, and, again, It's Always Sunny, you know, and I seem like an insane person, but it's definitely very difficult to bridge that gap in short conversations with everyday people. And I think that, you know, how do I say it? Like, just level-headed reporting on the subject could help a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely needed. It's definitely something I want to do more of. I think it's also, you know, on, I think, the community, right? Like, I think what's difficult about, like, reaching into these spaces is finding someone receptive who thinks it's important to, like, communicate what they're doing and why, right? A lot of the times, you know, you gotta go on Reddit, you know, FOSCAD, right? Like, you have to kind of like go into these realms and like piece together the puzzle and extrapolate and try and get people to talk to you when, you know, it's very sealed off. And I think, you know, this idea that you can create these things and remain anonymous and then them gain a certain level of prominence, whether it's used in a murder or it's used in an insurgency, yeah, right? Like, there's a certain level of ownership that you're just going to have to take for it, because that's the reality. Like, it's kind of the cat's out of the bag.
There's definitely a morbidity to that pride where, like, you know, everybody reveres Jay Stark because his guns are used in like actual rebellions. But there's also like Chairman Juan gets tagged in posts when they show up on, you know, like on the table with like the drugs and all the seized weapons, you know, and the cops are like showing off their bust. And like, that's like a point of pride for them too. Semi-ironically, right?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, there's got to be something to be said about freedom of speech here. And, you know, freedom of information, especially as a reporter, you know, I'm interested in what your thought is on the ultimate freedom of speech and information. You know, like you said, these files can be used for good or bad. And right, in the same sense, you know, you can report on something in a light that colors it good or bad, and you have the freedom to do that. And do you think that the two are related in the sense that, you know, the kind of responsibility and the kind of damage that can be done with just information and the ability to kind of like direct the way that that goes. I had a way that I wanted to ask that question, and it just came out. It kind of came out like, you know,
has anybody ever been wanted to go see more, look more like?
Yeah.
That kind of thing.
The duality of man. That's literally what was playing in my head right now. It's like, why do you've got a peace sign and whatchamacallit? from Platoon. All right.
No, that's not Platoon. That's Full Metal Jacket. Oh my God.
Cut that out.
I have not slept. I have not slept in 24 hours, so I'm struggling right now. I'm doing great.
Don't blame this on your kid.
No. I was at work last night.
All right.
Yeah, that's my shtick.
Yeah. It's your shtick. Yeah. Andrew's got three kids. I've just got horrible sleep discipline and a job that keeps me up at night.
Just thinking about fires. Oh, I hate
those. I wonder when it's going to happen.
Yeah, what's your top firefighter movie? I think you can't. Backdraft is immediately away.
Yeah, it's Backdraft. It's Backdraft.
As far as like the serious movies, Ladder 49 is probably one of my favorites.
Which one's the time travel one, or where the son is like talking to the dad across time?
You talking about Frequency?
Yeah, that's a good firefighter.
Oh, because he was a firefighter. Yeah, I guess it's a firefighter movie.
Whoa, that's not a fire.
Yeah.
No, it's not a firefighter.
It's a time travel firefighter.
He's
movie.
A firefighter in the movie, but it's
and
not.
And he
a
also fights
movie.
Crime.
Dude, wait, Ladder 49. That's John Travolta, right?
Yes, and Joaquin Phoenix.
That movie's sad. You can't rewatch that.
Oh, you know what? You know what is my favorite firefighter movie of all time? I really do think so. It's also a sad movie. I'm a sad boy for life. Like, I like sad stuff, to be honest. I don't know what it is.
Same.
It tugs like a string in my brain but Only the Brave.
Only the Brave is a
Wild and Firefighter movie. It's about the Granite Valley Mountain Hotshots.
From their inception to their final mission.
Yeah, that's a nuts movie. But
what's the one with, oh God, what is his name? Adam Sandler and Kevin, what's his name, the comedian, where they're gonna lose their benefits, so they have to pretend
that's
to be
Paul
married
Rudd.
To each other.
Yes. I forget.
Yeah,
they're
like married with kids, but the city is like canceling health benefits for firefighters. And it's the opposite. They're not married. I can't remember what it is. Anyways, they decide to get married to each other, even though they're not gay. Because like some contrived thing about how only married firefighters get health benefits. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
that's a firefighter movie, right?
Yeah, sure is. Sure is.
I love firefighter movies, dude.
I mean back to your question about like I think again like the difficulty of writing about 3D printing guns and like whatever light other than like in like this arm's distance, right, is that like, you know, my ask is always like the community can like take the wheel, right? Like they can, there's a certain level of engagement that would be helpful. You know, I think they're definitely members of the 3D printed gun community who do that and try to, you know, shape the conversation or at least inform reporters about what's X and what's Y. But yeah, I mean, it's a more advanced level because I think there are, right, so many layers as far as, you know, how the U.S. treats 3D printed guns, how Europe treats 3D printed guns.
And there's a lack of trust in that community because they've had a few specific incidents of stories being mishandled and members of the community being mishandled by the media. And there's almost like an unwritten policy across the at least FOSCAD of like they just automatically don't talk to journalists anymore. And you would have to like jump through hoops to like speak to them specifically on record about 3D printing stuff.
I mean, again, it's like the trust thing and the reputations that, you know, journalists, mainstream media have, right? And it's a bet. And like, again, finding people in those communities who are willing to kind of like take the chance and speak, you know, on the record about, you know, what they're passionate about or what they're working on. So
do you ever find that there is, obviously not with the times because you write about it, but do you hear anything either from your colleagues or just from people that you know from the industry of certain information relating to firearms being suppressed or being encouraged to be written about in certain lights, where, you know, it's to one side or the other?
No, I've never heard of anyone directing coverage of something in a certain way. Yeah, I can honestly say that when it comes to guns, you know, it's more, I mean, a lot of the times, like in the past, I've kind of been brought in to like identify maybe like a firearm used in a crime or write about it in a certain way. But yeah.
Do you think it has more to do with the standards that you work under, that the time sets, or do you think that's something that's like, cause I think of articles, you know, Slate comes to mind, where it's just like, it's opinion piece after opinion piece after opinion piece, but there's not really, you can tell when there's an opinion piece written in the Times because it says it very, very prominently. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really, there's certain media outlets that it's really hard to figure out like where the opinions begin and where the facts end. Do you think that has more to do with the standards that the Times holds itself to than, I don't know, the political temperature in the room, because it doesn't seem like everybody plays by those rules.
Yeah, I think it's tough. I think it kind of comes back to one of your earlier points about just like experience, right? And their frame of reference. Like if you're an editor of X or whatever publication and you've never, you know, handled an AR-15 or a firearm, and yeah, like you see something happen on the news, like your immediate like setting might be right of fear and fearfulness, and that kind of directs how like you push coverage of that. You know, I'm just speaking notionally. So I think that if you were to point any fingers, that would probably be the direction that I would look when you're kind of trying to pick apart, you know, why certain publications do X or Y. I don't know. I don't know if that answers your question.
It's all opinion stuff. You know, it's nice to get some insight into the industry because it's something that we're not familiar with. And I think everybody looks at the media like it's this boogeyman and a monolith, which it's not. You know, everybody, they're all.
If I like went to a notional 9 a.m. meeting and like the editor like shredded across the room, was like, all right, listen, ladies and gents, this week we're vilifying gun owners.
Yeah. You know, this is a top-down directive from the Illuminati. We're gonna shape public perception this week and this week only.
Yeah, what's that? Oh, man, why am I forgetting that Whiplash, the Spider-Man, Daily Bugle editor?
Yes, just like that.
Wait, what's his name? Why can't? Hold on.
I don't know, but you sounded like him, Andrew.
Yeah. What is it?
Yeah.
Well, because that's the actor, the way he played him in the Sam Raimi movies is like who I picture as that character forever. Yes, J.K. Simmons is the actor's name. I can't remember the character's name.
No, J.K. I was just looking for J.K. Simmons. Yeah, there's no like J.K. Simmons-esque character, you know, directing that kind. And I've never heard anything like that about any subject. Because if it was, I wouldn't.
Like, these are softball questions. Ask him why they love children being murdered.
Yeah. I mean, if that ever happened, I would not be employed by the New York Times or any.
Okay, bye.
Do you see yourself getting into like competitive shooting or anything like that? Because I know last time we were talking, you were putting an optic on your pistol, and
yeah, I would really like to. But I was supposed to take like an IDPA,
yeah,
learn like where they just kind of teach you the basics of a match, and you go through like the setup, and that's been pushed back because of like ice on the range for 2 months in a row.
Nice.
So I think it's rescheduled for the end of March. And I'm signed up to do a 2-gun shoot in June.
Cool.
Here.
Sick.
Yeah. And I'm pretty pumped with that. But I need to get a shot timer because I usually shoot indoors and I don't think it works on them, but I think it can work.
Yeah,
if I tweak it, but
it'll work. It'll work indoors. There might be some tweaking. Yeah, so like your neighbors don't set it off, but
yeah, I think you just have to be like one lane away.
Yeah.
Cool.
But yeah.
Yeah, there's you know, for somebody who's relatively new to the competitive stuff, like I'm not great, but it's a lot of fun. You know, we look forward to things like Woodland Brutality every year.
Yeah.
I have to get on Practice Score and look up local matches because there's no reason I should be just doing like three matches a year. You know, there's so many near me supposedly, because whenever I go on Practice Score and I type in my information, I get a map of different matches.
But we don't know those people, so it's hard.
Yeah, we don't know how cool they are or if they're not going to be nice to us.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if somebody's nice to you when you have a gun. That's no, I'm not saying you
that's
shoot
funny.
Him.
That's
I'm just saying,
funny.
Like,
no, I know.
I,
that's
you
funny.
Could be mean to me. I don't care. I'm going to shoot better than you.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Tell them why I got back into shooting. It's just the range that I go to. Everyone there has been super chill and welcoming, you know, because it's going to feel like there's that. Depending on where you go, it's like you don't know if you're going to get people who are like, why are you here? Like, I mean, I'm just here to shoot. But
fucking having
man, that's
fun,
one
bro.
Thing that I've like time and time again felt is pretty consistent with the gun community is that gun owners will by and large want you to shoot their guns if they see that you're like cool and you don't have many or you don't have the same kind of guns as them. I've been at, we have a like an outdoor range probably 35 minutes away from me. You know, I remember the guy next to me was shooting some like World War II bolt action. I don't even remember what it was, but he kept catching me looking at it. And then he just asked if I wanted to shoot it. And I was like, fuck yeah, I want to shoot it. I was like, you sure? Yeah, dude. It was like $7 a round. I forget what the hell he was shooting.
Oh, God.
But it was some weird shit with like a rounded tip. I remember that, you know, you did a story on GunTube and I think, did you bring up Tactical Girlfriend in GunTube or was that?
Yeah.
I remember reading about it. Something that we hear about frequently and, you know, like obviously as straight white cis dudes, like our experiences at the range are straight white cis
dudes. I heard great white cis dudes.
Wait, what? That's what you said, great white cis dudes.
Yeah, we've got three rows of teeth. That's why nobody bothers us at the range.
Straight white cis dudes, but I heard great white cis dudes.
Did it really sound like great white for both of you?
Yeah.
I think I'm just going to call it that from now on.
I am the great white cis.
Oh, what I'm saying is I think our experiences at the range are different than some people's.
Yeah,
Who do not, you know, for one way or another, either like pass as cis, pass as... like who they identify as. And, you know, I'm not talking about people who show up in comm block and, you know, it's like Soviet patches or whatnot. I'm just talking about somebody who wants to go to the range and shoot their gun. There is a portion of the gun community that is growing who doesn't still quite feel comfortable enough to do that based on either the area that they live. Like, do you think that's something that you're going to find yourself covering in the future, you know, shedding some light on that? Or
I mean, one of the things I've wanted, I mean, like when I at the range that I shoot at, like, you know, they do like some courses and some classes, and like their like weekly ladies nights are like sold out like every week. And I think generationally, you know, who works in like a brick and mortar gun store / gun range and who wants to come in, right? That's like kind of, you know, there's like an overlap now where like the older generations still kind of are wary of A, younger people, B, younger, like, I mean, I don't know the term non-traditional or people who you wouldn't, or I guess non-great white cis dudes, who come in. I think that's kind of hinted at in the GunTube, or like written about a little bit in the GunTube story, right? And in the new gun owner story that my colleague did, which was very well done. That kind of talks about this newer generation of hobbyists and shooters. And I think that's like a, you know, it's almost like in a way, like I'm in middle school and I played a ton of like Halo LAN parties with my friends. Like, that's not something I would like show up in homeroom and brag about, right? And like nowadays, like I can come on a podcast and be like, you know, I'm playing Red Dead Redemption, and I think that's like easier. It's just like, you know, culturally acceptable to play video games now, like much more than it was.
Yeah,
also, like,
I agree.
I think
with
being
that.
In eighth grade is tough, regardless.
Yeah.
So I think when it comes to like talking about owning a gun and shooting it and training or whatever, I think like generationally it's getting easier to talk about and easier to do, and more people are doing it. Yeah, I think again it's a huge line of coverage.
Because it's, you know, there's a, we were talking earlier about normalizing certain things, and it's one of the things that I find is a huge blind spot for liberals specifically who are not really involved in the gun community, is that I find that most people have this issue where they hold these strong beliefs and they have a pretty strong conviction up until it gets to the point where they have to test that conviction against something that they dislike. So, you know, I've heard countless people who identify as liberal say, you know, they're allies to the LGBTQ community
until some like trans person is like slightly pro gun, and then like, you know,
yeah, and then it's just you're just another pro gun conservative to them. You don't need a gun. Nobody needs an AR-15, and I feel like it's a disconnect because people are not in that community. They're not surrounded by it.
And
I feel like, you know, like I said earlier, I loved that there was that story on specifically on trans gun owners, because it's not something that affects me, and you know, it's something that for a portion of the population that is growing in the gun community, it's important to have that representation in mainstream media in order to kind of like bridge that gap between who they are and their peers.
And the important thing that's being missed, I think, and that interviews and reporting can really help with, is that, you know, trans people who are arming themselves in that community are not being won over by NRA propaganda. And they're like, yes, I'm trans, but also now I'm pro-gun. It's they are trans, and because of the circumstances around being trans right now, suddenly they're realizing organically, without any propaganda, without anybody coming to them, you know, and like having to argue with them and convince them, they're like, oh, suddenly, just of my own volition and experience, I see the need for a firearm, you know, and that's what's so compelling to me about this community of new gun owners, and something that I don't think is talked about enough, and I don't think is well understood in the anti-gun left, if that makes sense. I think that like exposure, you know, through media could really help with that.
Yeah, I mean, when I think about that kind of that conversation, I think about like, you know, Kamala Harris running for president, and you know, when she, I forget what talk show or whatever, she said she owns a Glock.
Yeah,
right. Like that, you know, how going back to like the video game comparison, you know, like a decade ago,
that maybe once upon a time that would have tanked her, but
well, yeah, or you know, just like been unfathomable, right?
So it's for even any president definitely to mention that.
Yeah,
right. Right. So, yeah, I think it's definitely a shift that needs to be honored and noted and written about.
There's a lot of changes going on, and not all of it good, but definitely not all of it bad.
I see a lot of hope. I see a lot of hopeful changes, but
I look at how much very anecdotally, how much a Better Way 2A is following has grown in the last 6 months. It's been significant. Certain subjects that, you know, were just kind of status quo, things that we would talk about now are like blowing up on social media. You know, like we did that post about how to show up armed to a protest and not look like an asshole. And it was extremely popular. And just showing that there is a growing number of people looking for this kind of stuff. You know, I've got some like hard days where I'm just like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I can't tell you the amount of times on a weekly basis people come into my DMs and they're like, thank you so much for doing what you're doing. It's just good to find a community here. And most of it's not even me. Most of it's just the people who follow the page,
people who share
our stuff. Like, it's not, I just make the posts, like, or not even all the posts. Like, we have writers too who are awesome. That's the kind of stuff that makes me really believe that this is going to be shaping the future for a lot of people. Gun ownership is being seen as a necessity by people now who never considered owning a gun in their lives. You know, I wish it weren't the case, and I wish people would have come to this conclusion
in more peaceful times, you know.
In a peaceful terms, yeah, exactly. But at the end of the day, you know, what is perspective but lived experience, and everyone's living experiences that they wish they never had to live now. That, and that's causing them to want to buy guns. But this is the gerbil in my brain right now, slowing down,
spinning the wheels.
Holy shit, brother! Right. That was a tough one.
I don't know if you have a response for that, but I also want to say that we have a couple of questions here.
You can just boot me on the forehead and tell me that you hit my snooze button. No more talking for 10 minutes.
We have a couple of questions here about your military service and how that kind of colors your reporting. Do you want to talk about that, or is that kinda...
Okay. I mean, yeah, dude, any questions?
So how do you think that your military experience colors your views on civilian gun ownership in America?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, my relationship to firearms, right, I grew up shooting. My dad was a Vietnam vet, he's a Navy guy who's just on a swift boat, and I remember when he first taught me how to shoot his 22 when I was like nine. You know, he said this is the first time I've picked up a rifle since Vietnam. Yeah, that was kind of like my childhood. I thought it was, I don't know, I thought, like, I grew up in Connecticut, I thought it was kind of an edgy thing to, like, know how to shoot. And then obviously joined the Marine Corps, you know, post 9/11, short kid trying to prove himself. And yeah, I was exposed to, right, like, committing violence, you know, in this war that we ultimately lost. And then as a journalist, you know, not having a firearm, being in these situations and watching people use these, you know, firearms, weapons, tools, right, to kill one another. I just have, like, all of these, I guess, like, lenses, like, levels of experience with guns. And now, you know, covering gun culture, you know, and shooting as a hobby is something, as a way to kind of, like, shut down my brain for a little bit. And do something that like I'm somewhat articulate or like trained enough where I know how to manipulate and shoot decent and get some kind of enjoyment or at least satisfaction. But I think when it comes to, like, approaching gun culture, it's like, it's always in the back of my head. I feel like it's like a nice stack, right? Because, like, you can get in the thing where you get an AR and you want to customize it and you want, like, your FDE stock and pistol grip to match your foregrip and, like, you know, that that part of the hobby where it's like, you know, aesthetics.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
You want this thing to look cool.
Yeah, for sure.
And then, like, in the back of my head, I know, like, the end result of this thing, like, what it can bring to the table.
Yeah,
that isn't shooting a paper target, or
in like a concrete, more than philosophical way, right?
In like a concrete way where you can, I can feel that feeling in my stomach of, like, sadness and pain and, like, abject horror, right? And, like, you could, and, like, being able to kind of, like, turn that on, and it's its own weird moral bag of tricks that I can wrestle with if I want to. But as far as, like, when I approach, like, these stories, I guess it's always just like a reminder of, like, what is. And it goes back to, like, toggling between, you know, how much exposition is needed, how much, like, you need to tell the reader this is this and this is what it can do, right? Like, I feel like I have a good benchmark there, right? Because, like, it's not all fun and games. It is a culture. It is a hobby. It is a thing. But I mean, like, these are guns.
It's wild though how you can juxtapose the immense pain associated with firearms, and the toll that they can inflict on people. And then you've got people on the other end of the spectrum who are doing things like making forward grips that look like ball sacks.
Yeah.
And, like, like McDonald's chicken nug sauce holders for the Picatinny rails.
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, and I know that's funny, but, like, I mean it in it's two in completely different sides of the spectrum.
It's kind of like a gallows humor thing, right? Like,
It's very much like an American thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, this is,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
This is this weird puzzle, like, whatever the United States is and, like, all its complexities, like, this is just some part of it that, like, you know, so much of the world just has, like, zero kind of experience understanding with, right?
Yeah,
like, where it's just like, you know, especially coming back from, like, overseas to here and then getting on this beat, it's like, if you take a step back, you're like, even the rooftop defense, you know, like, the Knights Armament battery caps on their T2s,
the, like, prestige of, like, GWAT drip, you know,
Right. I watched some video and this dude had like modified like a Block 2 and he's like, yeah, this is G-Watt era cool.
Yeah, right. Just, like, it's like, dude, I was in G-Watt. What are you fucking?
I nearly split down the middle of like G-Watt, like, dude, like, buddy, like, I get where you're going with this, but there's many things that I feel about being G-Watt era.
Do you think it's funny to see like these Iraqi special forces now with like vertical broom handle grips on their ARs? Not funny, but like in the sense that they've never had things like that before. They're like, these are cool, these bipod grips, and we're like, those are the dumbest things ever invented.
Yeah, I mean the cloners. I mean they really get, they like the grip pod. The grip pod has since I first saw them in 2009. I thought they were garbage. They just looked terrible. Yeah. But and unwieldy. But no, I mean Iraqi Soft, like hanging out with them and Mosul, and you know they just had like knockoff 511 everything, like it was just kind of like they were, and the fight was nuts and they were doing just extraordinary stuff in the confines of this, you know, urban battleground, but so much of their like aesthetic was migrated from, you know, American soldiers that they had trained with in, you know, Operation Iraqi Freedom. And then kind of like the cloners are just like an extension of the Iraqi Soft in a way, right?
On the one hand, in the field, you have, you know, the ethos is that, you know, function drives form, right? Like, you know, you're trying different things and you're trying new products and you're trying to figure out like how to get the gun out of the way of the guy using it, right? But then when you're a cloner, it's the opposite. It's like it's all aesthetic, and it doesn't really matter to the cloner how effective the broom handle grip pod really was. It's you know that showed up in pictures, and those pictures,
or the EOTech mounted forward of the carrying handle.
It's like, you know, it's just like a purely aesthetic thing to someone who, and I don't know if all cloners, I don't know what the breakdown is on like whether any of them served or were in combat or not, but you know, I'm sure
we talking clone, like people who like building clone, correct rifles, like in general. Because I know people who like GWAT, like stuff for Woodland Brutality. I was toying with the idea of doing like a Black Hawk Down,
LARP,
you know, just for like shits and giggles.
Well, I mean, on like the serious side of like, right, like when I left the Marine Corps in 2011, you know, I was living in North Carolina and I immediately got my concealed carry because like I had just been on, you know, difficult deployment. I always had a weapon near me, and I was like moving to Durham, North Carolina, and like I wanted to always have like a firearm near me. Like I wanted to have a pistol on my belt or a pistol in my truck, because like it was just like I would definitely relate that to like, you know, post-traumatic stress or like some kind of trauma reaction, right? So like if you could spin it like cloners wanting to like recreate like a rifle that they carried, because it gives them a sense of, you know, security. And I mean, honestly, like, you know, if we're really getting into it, like, you know, me shooting and, you know, getting back into shooting and shooting an AR-15, like I'd be silly to say like there isn't like a level of comfort that comes with, you know, stripping an AR and taking the bolt apart, right? It's like such a familiar part of my brain from like an earlier part of my life that like, you know, gives some semblance of security, right? Like of some, you know, familiarity when everything is, you know, crazy or I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, right? But I know like how to strip a BCG, like I've got that. So
I mean
I'm sure some cloners would know, you know, it's like a different vibe, whether it's like a hobbyist like perfecting a car, but you never know.
Do you have any interest in talking about mental health?
Yeah, for sure. I mean,
this is something that's like near and dear to our hearts here. You know, we talk about suicide statistics and PTSD and trauma and therapy and all this stuff. We did it more in our earlier episodes, I feel like, when it was mainly Andrew and I. But you know, this is something that I feel like, in the same sense that gun owners bring up crime statistics to distract from anti-gun bills whenever they come up, like we don't bring up crime statistics unless there's like a bill that's on the table that's going to restrict our rights. I feel like in the same way, you see anti-gun or gun control advocates don't ever bring up suicide statistics when it comes to like preventing suicides by gun, unless they're talking about the overall number of deaths and they're including that.
or as like a justification for gun control, as opposed to like any other kind of like mental health.
Yeah, program. Mental health care, or like, you know, Medicaid for all, whatever you want to call it, but something that improves the mental health of the people in the country. You know, I think that with the majority of gun owners being men and the majority of suicides being men, especially men over 40, mental health is something that like we are lacking. Mental health care is something that we are lacking in this country at a level that is absurd. In your particular case, you know, I'm assuming you had the VA. I don't know what your experience with that was, but there's a stigma against things like, we have a good VA here, but I know depending on where you land in the country, you could have a completely separate, completely opposite experience. There's a stigma against socialized medicine, especially in the gun community, because the gun community is largely conservative, but the VA works for a lot of people. And I was wondering if, you know, based on your experience, if you think a format like the VA has for people coming back from deployments would work on the general population as far as mental health care goes, as far as, you know, like decompressing after a stressful incident, things like that. There's a lot of meat to that question. I apologize. I'm just, you know, I find that we don't talk about mental health enough in the sense of like, okay, we have a problem, but what are we going to do?
Yeah. Everybody knows that it's a problem, but everybody wants to use it instead of solving a problem. They want to use it as an excuse for why you shouldn't do this thing that they don't like.
Yeah, exactly. You know, based on your experience, like, what do you think would work for people if we were to implement something? I know you're not like a...
let's fix suicidality right now.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like, I have a decent amount of experience with friends who, you know, have killed themselves, you know, sometimes with a firearm. You know, like, obviously I'm no expert, and like, when I've dealt with people who were threatening suicide or were kind of in that space, I think, you know, it always comes down, like, I don't know what a, you know, a nationalist or national program would look like, you know, an expansion of what the VA does or doesn't do. But as far as, yeah, I think being able to articulate your mental health, ask your friends for help, like, it's all about proximity, right? To me, that's always what it comes down to, is like, who, like, the person that is in trouble, like, who is in their immediate, like, vicinity, how literate are they talking about, you know, mental health, like, seeking help. Like, I've had people who've, you know, just, I'm to the point where if it like comes up, like someone mentioned suicide, like I'll call the cops like immediately. Like, I just, you know, in wherever they are, like, you know, whatever their address is, it'll be like a health and wellness check. And that's happened a few times, just because, you know, for my own sake, like, I'm not going to be like, well, I should have done this. Like, I've lost enough people where it's just the toggle is like, yeah, I'm calling.
And is that generally helpful? Cops doing a wellness check?
You know, it's proximity. Like, I'm not, you know, six hours away on a plane, or, you know, I'm not like right there. So it's like, this is the best I can do. If I can't get a friend there who's in town, like, there just needs to be. And sometimes that's helped, right? Because it's like a realization that person needs, you know, institutional help, or needs to seek, you know, aggressive therapy or whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's like a really tough thing to crack. But I mean, like, again, not going to come down on like statistics or whatever, but when this is happened a lot, you know, somebody's in a bad spot, like, the first question I was like, do they have a gun in the house?
Yeah. Right. Well, that's happened to my childhood friend of mine, Brick Monroe. He was suicidal, you know, many years ago. He lived in Austin, Texas, and police showed up and were not able to like handle the situation. And they tried to tase him and it failed. And he came out with like a fairly realistic looking BB gun. And so they shot him.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, it's not like, you know, I'm not like competing for sympathy or anything, but it's just something it's one of the reasons why I'm so frustrated with the state of the number of tools that we have for responding to people in a mental health crisis like that are so limited, and many of them are not the right tools. I can understand that it would be very frustrating to be like on the phone with somebody and realizing that they might be suicidal, and like, you know, it could be that like calling the cops is like the only thing that you can do, you know?
Well, and I think that's what you were saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that, you know, as far as the tools that you have at your disposal, not doing anything and hoping for the best versus calling the cops,
right,
and it being a decision and some kind of resource that can help is better than not doing anything in your experience.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, and then I think I talked to him, like former Marine Commandant, like Robert Neller, about this. Cause you know, like amount of people that my battalion's lost in combat versus from suicide, you know, is exponentially more by suicide.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And this idea that, right, like if you're a squad leader and you know how to do like combat medicine, like why can't you also know like stuff about mental health and like mental, like how to navigate, you know, mental injury or moral injury or any of this stuff. Like even if you just know the DDE or the acronyms,
yeah,
and like you can look for that in your thing, because so many times, like, you know, the mental injury or a moral injury equivalent is just like a mental double amputee, right? Where, you know, they're just incapacitated internally. And like, how do you, if you have that literacy as a squad leader, when you get out, you're going to take it with you when you're looking for it in your guys or girls who are, you know, who left, and you're kind of trying to look after them afterward. I don't know. It's something, it sucks. And it never seems like there's the right answer. And it always seems like, well, you figured it out and it was too late. You know, my assistant team leader, you know, he was in a really rough spot, and he got on a motorcycle drunk and died. You know, I remember like months before, you know, he was like drunk in the barracks. It was before I left the Marines. And I think I said like, you know, Matt's going to kill himself. Matt's like, he's just on this like slope of destruction. And I think maybe like pride, or I just like didn't know how. I was, you know, 21, 22, but like didn't know how to handle it.
Didn't
like,
know what to
talk
do.
About it.
Like what was the
you
next
didn't know
step.
What to do. And then he died.
Yeah.
And like, that'll always. And I think like that really, as it went, you know, I tried really hard to get better at dealing with those situations, but you know, I guess regret, or, you know, it's always like, oh, well, you made the best decision you could with the information you had at the time, but yeah, he's not going back.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's tough, man. I think it's definitely built into the stigma of, you know, guys not asking for help, guys not showing emotion. Guys, especially not showing emotion around their other guy friends. I took a class years ago on the employee assistance program, which is like a peer-to-peer mental health program that we have with the fire department. Multiple fire departments do it. You know, I remember one of the exercises they had us do that was so uncomfortable was they literally just had us sit across from the person next to us, look at them in the eyes, and ask them if they were going to kill themselves.
Oh.
And it just literally saying the words, because it's many times people have reported that it's feels so uncomfortable and so unnatural to say that they don't say it. And they'll say like, you know, are you going to hurt yourself, or are you going to do something stupid, or are, you know, don't be an idiot, or things like that. And then, you know, they go out and inevitably do it. It's because it's, for some reason, it's like subconsciously ingrained into us. It's so hard to ask that question.
It's like an extension of the bystander effect, right? Of like seeing a car accident, be like, well, an ambulance will come. Like someone else will be there, you know, like someone else will step in. And that's like when your friend or like is distributing, like, well, you know, like his girlfriend or his mom, like, you know.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, they're probably having the same conversation with them. Like, I don't need to do anything. And then, you know, it kind of comes down to like, nobody's coming. It's up to us. You know, it's like that kind of mantra.
Yeah. Yeah. It's 30 seconds out, I think, has stickers that say that.
Yeah.
I've got one of those bottom of my helmet.
This is my ATL's helmet. His mom gave to me. Amazing. Spray painted it. So yeah. And it still has like,
oh,
you can still see like the Marpat
cover,
like shoe goot on. It's still kind of there. But
that's awesome, cool, man. That's cool. You have that.
Yeah, no. War in Ukraine, war in Afghanistan. It's kind of like hanging out.
Really?
With me. Yeah.
That's
it's
sick.
My press helmet.
That's cool. Is that what it says on the back there?
Yeah. Press and then in Ukrainian.
That's awesome, man. I think we did some damage. this was through no help of from me, but I appreciate you.
Don't sell yourself short.
I mean, it is wild what like little sleep will do to you. And I'm just sitting here. There were a couple times where I was like,
it seemed like you were mid sentence and kind of forgot what you were asking about.
Dude, there were a couple times where I was just like, the words kept coming, but I did not see the end. And I was just like, man, this you're is fine, fucking man. Awesome.
You know, the first time I did marijuana in Minecraft, hypothetically, this is a joke, by the way. I had this experience of like
comparing my current situation to
no. You're gonna understand. Weed. You're gonna understand. I had this experience where everything that I was saying to me as it came out sounded like fucking gibberish. It sounded like nonsense. I would plan a thing to say. I would say it. And I'd be like, that didn't make any sense. That didn't make any sense. I'm not making any sense. But to everyone else in the room, they could not tell. It was normal. I was speaking normally. I was completely understandable. I was carrying on a completely normal conversation.
So Jordan was like the inverse of that.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. I had an idea, and to everybody else, they were like, what the fuck are you talking about?
I hung on. Yeah. I was there for it.
No, you're doing fine. You're doing fine. That's what I was trying to say is that I think that sometimes it sounds worse as you're saying it than it does to the people that you're talking to.
Sounded pretty bad as I was saying it. It wasn't that bad.
I'm pretty sure like everybody in this podcast has like some massive inferiority complex that we're all wrestling with on a daily basis.
Yeah. Oh, so. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, dude, I'm constantly battling with imposter syndrome and you just added to it today. So appreciate
that. I'm sorry if I did.
No. Dude, it's just, you know what it is? It's, I am very fortunate to meet people like yourself, like Andrew. You know, this whole venture has been nothing short of illuminating, and I'm extremely privileged and fortunate to be a part of this whole thing. You know, I truly believe that the gun community is, and I'm sure everybody says this about their hobby with the people that they hang out with, but I truly believe that the gun community is comprised of some of the most genuine and caring and dedicated people, like to the cause, because there's so much at stake. And, you know, I feel like I fit that bill. So when I've got an opportunity to talk to someone who is in their field, very respected, and I don't know, it's just, it's, you know, I've been on cloud nine all day today since reading that article, and, you know, only had
it was a very nice photo.
It was cool. Yeah. It was a good photo of me. I was like, I remember asking the photographer if I should, like, I think I asked him if I should smile with my teeth or not. And I think I said that I usually think I'm smiling, but I'm not. And,
he was probably like, I don't care.
No, he was a cool dude. He was a really cool dude. But that picture was a good mix of me, like how I normally think I'm smiling, which is like, and actually smiling, but not looking like a weirdo. So yeah, I don't know. That was cool. It's the whole thing. Cool. I don't know. It's been great having you on, man. I wish I was more coherent.
No, dude, you were good. You were good. Good. I mean, I'm happy when I put a sentence together, like, and not say and you know, 14 different times.
Yeah, we definitely have to hit the range because you're close enough, man. I'll make sure to get a full night's sleep before that. Yeah, we should definitely do something sometime soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Probably in Connecticut because I can't bring my mags to your state. I don't think.
What are they, over 10 rounds?
Yeah. Well, most I don't have any 10 round AR mags because I got them all before the ban.
The ban.
Okay.
Yeah, I probably shouldn't say that on the internet, but no, nothing that I already said. Nothing I have is illegal. I'm just, you know, some things get taken out of context and all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, if you had, this is something we ask all of our guests towards the end of the podcast, but if you had a piece of advice for people. It could be related to guns. It could be related to anything, really. It
could just be like a quality of life tip. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Keep a journal.
Keep a journal. Ooh. I don't do that. I should do that.
Interesting. Just to look back on?
Yeah, look back on. I mean, just like, I don't know. I kept a journal on both my deployments that I kind of turned into a journal during my reporting time in Afghanistan and Ukraine. Now it's still kind of just like a place where, I mean, it just kind of helps you, you know, like materialize like all these thoughts you kind of have going through your head all the time into like a box that you can understand better as you put it down. And like, it lets you kind of filter out like what's important and what isn't, and like what's actually going on in your life, and like what's kind of driving you to do one thing or the other. And I've found it to be extremely helpful, and it's just a great thing to look back on. So yeah, keep a journal.
I love that piece of advice, man. There's like, there's been a couple nuggets of wisdom that people have shared with us where I've been like, damn. But that's like, that's one of those, I've had multiple journals throughout the years, but I've never stuck to one. I had one when I was in SOI. I had one in middle school that's super fucking cringy that I still have. It's hilarious to read.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, you're 100% right. Like, writing things down, and especially being able to look back on them. Even my SOI one is super cringy. I fucking hate it, but it's still cool to see and read.
Yeah, it's still cool.
Yeah, no, it's great. Like, it's a piece of your, it's a piece of who you were back then. There's no way to feel better than to realize how far you've come by literally seeing it in your own words. Yeah, that's an excellent piece of advice, man. I'm
going
to go find my sweet notebook that I have, and I'm going to write in something tonight.
Not tweaking an AR, you can basically like find like the perfect moleskin, you know, perfect pen. I'm a big space pen guy.
What about journaling by voice memo? I bet that would be fun to comb through your ancestors. Just like 18 gigabytes of unhinged stream of consciousness.
It's a good, yeah, like Starlog. But that's like a good place to start.
Yeah.
You're like,
nice.
Because like you text so much. So like a good way to kind of like get into it is just like writing a note on your phone and then writing it down on paper. Like I've had to do that a couple times when just like writing on paper was just like so difficult because I had so much shit going on that like, I can only write on my phone. So yeah, anyway works. Like you find a place to store it and save it. But I like having physical copies.
Physical copies are cool. I'm big on like printing photos, and I have a huge OneDrive of like photos and stuff, but I'm big on printing photos. I email myself voicemails from people.
Well,
like if I get a particularly sweet voicemail from my wife or
transcribe it. That's awesome.
I have a subscription with Google Pictures that I guess they use like an AI or something to randomly pick like the 10 of the best, clearest pictures that I took in the previous month, and then they print them and send them to me.
That's cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Take the guesswork out of it.
Yeah.
Cool, man. Well, thanks for coming on, man. This was fun. This was, Andrew, can you imagine if we did this at 9 at night?
No, I'd be asleep.
We've done a couple, like, Andrew's hit or miss, like, after the sun goes down.
Sometimes I'm, like, with it, and sometimes I am about to pass out. And sometimes I sleep through the podcast.
I think from every time we've been together, I have a picture with him sleeping next to me.
In an inappropriate place.
At the bar. I have two of you at the bar. Not drunk, just tired.
Yeah.
Just asleep.
No, and I did both. At SHOT Show, I did both. I was tired and fell asleep. And then on the last day, like 5 hours before my flight, I was at a bar with Beer Archist, and he fed me a bunch of pizza, and I blacked out from drinking. And I don't remember getting home.
Dude, the other night I had a Shake Shack milkshake, and it put me to sleep by 9:45. Drank no alcohol.
Yes.
It just like demolished me.
I think milkshakes are, we'll let you go after this, but I think milkshakes are probably one of my all-time favorite consumables.
And yeah, milkshakes, incredible.
Like morale booster, I mean.
And it's good, clean calories, man. That's just like fat and protein from the milk.
I've never thought of it like that. If it's like normal ice, I don't know. Yeah, clean. I don't know if it's like eating clean.
Good, clean calories. It's clean,
chicken
buddy.
Milkshakes. trying to get my. I don't know. I'm definitely got no shortage of carbs in my life, but
you can kind of fake it by just putting milk in a blender with ice. And be like, it's a milkshake.
No. We have Quest milkshakes. Quest protein powder. It's low carb. And
my son's trying to give me another energy drink. Sick. I see it. Thank you.
All right. On that note, talking about low carb Quest.
Yeah. Get out of here. Get off my computer, guys.